and that is none other than the ninth wonder of the world.
China.
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 China,
China, China,
China,
China,
China,
China,
China,
China,
China.
You take China.
China.
China. China.
China.
China.
China.
China. I have to have my China.
China.
China, because China.
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 China. Now.
China.
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 I know China very well.
China.
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 China in particular.
China.
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 China,
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 China.
I've been saying China,
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 China.
Let me ask you about China.
In China, they say I don't like China. I love China.
People think I don't like China. I love China.
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 Is the new China, by the way.
China.
China.
China. I deal with China.
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 Big league China.
So don't tell me about China. I know China. China.
China. China. China. China.
I don't knock China. You have China. Carl, take China. And by the way, I love China. I mean, I love China. How can you not love China? I love China.
China.
China. People say, oh, you don't like China. I like China.
China.
I love China.
China.
China all the time.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Well, if China ever does go into the Hall of Fame, I think we found the person who can do the induction. This is episode 405 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, October 18, 2015. I am the Solid Monster. The Mets beat the Dodgers. They're in the NLCS against the Cubs. I think I had about 17 heart attacks the other night watching that Game 5, but they pulled through, and now it's the Mets and the Cubs. Mets took Game 1 last night up on the Cubbies, and they're going to go all the way to the World Series. I predict a Mets-Royals World Series, and I know we have a lot of fans listening from Toronto. I am pulling for the Blue Jays, but it's not looking too good right now. So if I had to make a bold prediction, my prediction is Mets and Royals in the World Series. A lot of blue coming up in the World Series this year. We got a lot to get to this week. I got something to say about this whole Rusev-Lana situation. Boy, do I have something to say. And we're also going to clear up a little TNA story. We're going to give you the real reason why TNA canceled its Halloween tour at the end of the month, despite what TNA may be saying publicly. We'll have the actual reason a little later on in the show. And we're also continuing the countdown. Eight of my favorite WWE matches of all time in celebration of our 8-year anniversary show, which is coming up on November 8th. Which, if I don't miss any shows between now and then, would just so happen to be episode number 408. It's just funny how it's working out that way. So anyway, we'll be doing match number 5 this week. Just to recap, match number 1 was the 1992 Royal Rumble match. Match number 2 was Steve Austin and Dude Love from Over the Edge in 98. Match number 3, Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker, greatest WrestleMania match of all time from WrestleMania 25. And match number 4 was Bret Hart and Mr. Perfect in the semifinals of the 1993 King of the Ring. Match number 5 coming up is a bit more current, and actually one of the better WWE matches of the last decade. And it's a shame they blew the damn thing off as quickly as they did. So we'll reveal what that is after the mailbag, so stick around for that. But first, got to give some love to Audible. Audibletrial.com/Solid Monster is our URL. It's ours. Belongs to us. And we need to make use of it. So if you have not yet already done so, plug that URL in. Sign up for an Audible trial. You can sample the service free for 30 days. You are under no obligation. If you want to cancel, you can cancel at any time in those 30 days and not be billed. But once you sign up, you get one free audiobook that you get to cash in on. And that belongs to you no matter what you do. So it can be the new Daniel Bryan book, it could be the Chris Jericho book, it could be Shawn Michaels' latest book, it could be anything you want it to be, as long as it's on Audible. And chances are it is, because they've got about 180,000 different books up there to choose from. So use our URL, audibletrial.com/Solid Monster, go through the sign-up process, get your free book, you can thank me later, And spread that URL around to anybody who you think may find it useful. And also, don't forget, we have a store. I haven't been showing it as much love lately, so some people may not be aware that we have a store up on ProWrestlingTees.com. It's ProWrestlingTees.com/SalaMonsterSoundsOff. We've got over 20 shirts up there right now. They ship all over the world, up to a size 5XL. You can get the soft cotton on some of them. I prefer soft cotton. You know, the couple of shirts that I bought of mine, yes, I had to buy them. I don't get them for free. I go for the soft cotton, but you can get whatever you want. And it's all up at our store right now, so show some love for the Sound Off and buy a shirt. Last but not least, you can make a PayPal donation on thesalamonster.com any day of the week. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. $30 or more will get you a nickname and a quick shout-out for your own podcast or YouTube channel. Or if maybe it's something else, if you're unsure whether or not you can get a shout-out for it, just email me and ask. So I want to give some love this week to those who have supported the show. Robert Murray, thank you very much. Yvonne Bruiser Balick, Chuck Lunatic Lentz, Case Closed Aaron Kloss, Damn Straight Michael Dorsey, True Grit Tim Goggin, Trevon the Cannon Clark, Deadpool James Herrera, Light 'Em Up Lamont Ambler, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Filthy Rich Richard Sanders, who has started a Drunk Movie Reviews channel on YouTube. And their first review goes up this Wednesday, October 21st. It's Back to the Future Day, which I wasn't aware of until a couple of days ago. But apparently, this is a thing now. This Wednesday coming up is officially Back to the Future Day. I saw Toyota got Christopher Lloyd and Michael J. Fox back together. They're sitting in a diner. They filmed like a little mini movie with them. There's a trailer up on YouTube. The full movie's coming out Wednesday. It's pretty cool stuff. But anyway, Richard's channel officially goes live on Wednesday. They will review, what else, the original Back to the Future. So the easiest way to find his channel is to go to their Facebook page, facebook.com/DMReviewsPage. And from there you can find the link to the channel. So Richard, good luck with that. And again, thanks everybody who made a donation this week. One more quick plug. This Tuesday, October 20th, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I will be appearing on Under the Mat Radio. You can go to blogtalkradio.com/underthematradio. J.J. Dillon is scheduled to be on the show that night as well, I think before me. So blogtalkradio.com/underthematradio. You can check me out on there this Tuesday. ESPN will be covering WWE every week on SportsCenter going forward with a weekly segment Tuesdays at 9 p.m. The first came this past week, hosted by Jonathan Coachman, who was the one who really spearheaded this whole thing. Obviously, Coach, coming from WWE, big WWE fan. He has been pushing ESPN for the longest time to cover WWE. I think the whole SummerSlam deal this summer where they covered it for SummerSlam weekend was kind of a test to see how things went, and it went well. And there's, you know, crossover between the two audiences. ESPN is looking to bolster SportsCenter. WWE obviously looking to get the mainstream rub from ESPN. So it's mutually beneficial for both sides. Coach interviewed Seth Rollins last week. I saw part of it. They recapped some of the things that happened on Raw last Monday. They talked about his feud with Kane, which I'm sure will get those football fans to start watching Raw. Oh yeah, that'll work. They talked about Chase Utley and his dirty slide on the Mets last week. Rollins said in wrestling they're at least trying to protect one another, unlike that punk. I said that, not Rollins. Each week, what they're going to do is they're going to recap the top moments from Monday Night Raw, which, if the past month is any indication, that could end up being a very short segment. The product is so cold right now. It almost doesn't feel like the right time to be doing this, right? You would think that if the product was on an upswing and it was hot and people were getting into it, you know, that's why ESPN would want to cover it and there would be some excitement there. And there's no excitement. You know, it's just a cold, dead product right now. I don't see this adding any new viewers for WWE, but it's airtime on SportsCenter. You know, if you can make that deal in your WWE, you would be foolish not to do it. So this is actually a pretty big deal, but it just doesn't feel like it because they're in such a down period right now. But it's funny to look back, you know, when I was younger, two things I wanted, like when I was in my teens. I wanted a 24-hour-a-day wrestling channel. Because when wrestling was hot and wrestling was at its peak, that's what you wanted. You never wanted it to end, right? 3 hours was not enough. Now it's too much. Back then it wasn't enough. So you wanted a 24-hour-a-day wrestling channel. And I wanted to see wrestling covered like a real sport. Especially during the Monday Night Wars. With everything that was going on during that whole period and guys jumping shit back and forth. I mean, I got most of my news at that time. You know, you had the dirt sheets, but I wasn't subscribed to any newsletters or anything like that. There used to be a thing called his name? Peter Skoretta. Peter Skoretta, who now I think works for or runs the /film website. He's like a film website guy now. I don't think he has anything to do with wrestling, but at the time, he was running his own little online wrestling newsletter, I think called Matt Rap, or Matt Rat, I forgot what it was called. The Slammer. I think he called himself The Slammer. That's how I used to get my news, and obviously he was pulling his news from the dirt sheet. At the time, I didn't know that, but that's how I kept in the loop on what was going on and who was jumping to what brand, and it would have been cool, and it would have made life so much easier to have, like, an ESPN, whether it was in magazine form or on television, covering WWE or covering WCW when they were at their peak and they were pulling 10, 11 million people on television every week. It would have been cool to have them covering, hey, who's jumping ship to what brand and that kind of stuff. And that was at a time when everybody, even if they didn't want to admit it, everybody was watching pro wrestling. And now we've got both. We've got a 24-hour channel, and we've got coverage on ESPN. Not quite the same as it would have been 15 years ago, but still a big deal nonetheless. Raw, this past week, was live in Chicago, Illinois. And this Raw show is not the only disappointment the fans in Chicago are going to be experiencing in the month of October. Shout out to Andrew, if you're out there listening, for the Wrestling Soup / Solid Monster sign that made TV a bunch of times on the hard camera. I think most of you people probably saw it. I was getting tweets all night long about it. So, it made it on TV a whole bunch of times before Kim Jong McMahon over there backstage sent word to his lieutenants to have security take the sign away. I missed most of the show live because I was watching the Mets game and I had to go back and watch Raw the next day, which was awesome because that allowed me to fast forward through all the parts I didn't care to watch. I think I may have found my new favorite way to watch Raw every week. Triple H and Stephanie were not able to make it to the show this week. They were held up in traffic, whatever. The storyline was that there were flight delays or something, and so while they were running late, in their absence, they put Corporate Kane in charge of running the show. He then made the main event a lumberjack match between Seth Rollins and himself. And when Triple H and Stephanie found out about it, they wanted him under no circumstances to wrestle Seth Rollins. So, he had to find a suitable replacement, and you can figure out who that replacement was. And what the outcome of the match was, too, also should not be in any doubt. You didn't have to watch Raw to know what the outcome of this match was going to be. I can't even call Seth Rollins a champion anymore. It's hard for me to call him a champion. A champion would not have a win-loss record of something like 1-10 over the last month. He's not the champ. He's the chump. That's what he is. He is the WWE World Heavyweight Champion. That's what I'm going to call him from now on. I mean, is it any wonder why this guy is so flat right now? I think it's safe to say the U.S. title has now surpassed the WWE title in terms of value and in terms of how it's positioned in this company. And it was very clever on WWE's part. Yeah, very, very slick. People were so happy after WrestleMania to see John Cena phased out of the title picture. He's being pushed down out of the main event picture. In reality, he was never phased out of anything. He still headlines Raw some weeks, and then the weeks he doesn't, he's still the featured match on the show. His U.S. Open Challenge has, I would say, most weeks been the highlight of the show ever since WrestleMania. And when you look at house shows, how often does Seth Rollins even defend the WWE title on those shows? Most of the time, when you look at the house show lineups and the results, it's John Cena and Seth Rollins, and they're wrestling for the United States Championship. This weekend on the house show loop, they did 30-minute Iron Man matches, and it was the U.S. title on the line, not the WWE title. Why? Because they don't want to have Seth Rollins beating John Cena. So, of course, Cena won all the matches. I mean, this weekend isn't even over yet. There's a show tonight, and I'm going to look into my Magic 8-Ball, and my Magic 8-Ball is telling me that John Cena will win that match as well. John Cena is still very much positioned as the man in this company. And Seth Rollins is playing second fiddle. And when you're constantly booked in matches with John Cena, aside from SummerSlam, there's only one possible outcome. And I don't think the WWE champion should be booked to lose 95% of his matches. But that's just my opinion. Randy Orton and Dean Ambrose agreed to be partners against Luke Harper and Braun Strowman at Hell in a Cell, or more specifically, the Hell in a Cell kickoff. Yes, Randy Orton and Dean Ambrose are wrestling on the pre-show next Sunday. New Day came out. They mocked Randy Orton for being part of so many factions throughout his career. Evolution, Legacy, The Authority. Dude's got nothing on Triple H. Look at Triple H. DX, DX version 2, the corporation, the corporate ministry, the McMahon-Helmsley regime, Evolution, DX version 3, and now The Authority. I dare one of the writers to script that into the show one of these days. You see what happens to him. New Day beat Orton and Ambrose off a miscommunication by the babyfaces. Kofi actually rolled up Randy Orton for the pin, so Kofi Kingston gets his revenge on Randy Orton after all these years. Nikki Bella pinned Naomi with the rack attack. Before the match, they showed highlights from the Iron Man match at TakeOver between Sasha Banks and Bayley to ensure that during this match, with Sasha standing outside the ring, the crowd would chant, "We want Sasha," which they gladly obliged. Either that was their intent, you know, that was their goal here, maybe to make Sasha feel like a big deal and they knew exactly what they were doing, or they are completely fucking brain dead airing those highlights before a Nikki Bella match because nobody cared one iota about the actual match in the ring. All they wanted to do was chant, "We want Sasha." Brie Mode jumped up on the announce desk at one point with a mic and started her own "We Want Sasha" chant, which, again, makes me think this was all part of the plan to try to get Sasha over. So Sasha walked over, and she yanked her off the table, and Brie Mode fell to the floor. John Cena came out for his open challenge. This week, it was Dolph Ziggler, after Ziggler's errant super kick to Cena the week before. Cena stopped the match early, like barely a minute in, not even a minute in, to acknowledge a guy in the crowd that had just proposed to his girlfriend. And she said yes. See, now, if they did want to turn the Total Diva stuff into a storyline, what a conniving heel Dolph Ziggler would be if we ended up finding out that he staged the whole proposal during this match as a way to make Nikki Bella feel even worse about the fact that John Cena won't marry her. But see, now I'm getting far too creative with this now. But really, I mean, given what John Cena thinks of marriage, I'm surprised he didn't offer his condolences to the guy. The Ziggler transformation into Shawn Michaels continues. Now he does the foot stomp before he goes for the super kick. I thought these two guys had a really good match. Not shocking. Usually when they wrestle, they have a really good match. But it was a really good match marred by a bad finish. I hated that John Cena kicked out of both the super kick and the zigzag, which is, of course, Dolph Ziggler's finish. And then Cena hits one AA and he pins him 1-2-3. Now look, I am all for making finishes stronger by not having people kick out of them a million times, but they continue to make John Cena look strong at the expense of guys who need that push a hell of a lot more than he does. That's my problem with this. Dolph Ziggler needs that push. He needs his moves to look good. He needs that put behind him a hell of a lot more than John Cena does. But you know, whatever. I mean, they've been doing this for years and years and years, and they never learn. You know, and hey, how come Cena's over and everybody else is three levels below him? You know, they'll ask that question, I'm sure. They never learn, and they never will. So, good match, terrible finish. Sheamus and King Barrett beat Cesaro and Neville in a 3-minute match when Sheamus pinned Neville after Barrett blindsided him with a bullhammer. I saw in an interview that Wade Barrett wants to be part of the tag team division. You know, he probably realizes there's no room for him as a singles guy to really break through. I mean, he sees the lay of the land. It's not as though that all of a sudden he's going to get this big push or, you know, a title opportunity. He knows that. So he wants to jump into the tag team thing. And he said he would love to team with Neville. To which I say, no, 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 no. Not that I don't think they would make a good team. I just have absolutely no desire to see them as a team. And I hate the fact that he might be giving them ideas. See, here's the thing. Barrett is a dead duck. Okay, we all know that. he's dead. But Neville can still be saved. Right now, he's not, like, buried. He's just in purgatory. He's just there. He's not doing anything. Nobody cares. He's another guy in the roster. He can still be saved. He's a hell of a lot better than what they have him doing now. I would much rather see Barrett and Sheamus become a team like they were on this show. First of all, I think they can make a pretty good team. More importantly, it keeps Sheamus out of the singles picture. I just find this guy to be ungodly boring. Ungodly boring, and what a waste of a briefcase putting that thing on him. I say get that briefcase off of him, somehow maybe get it onto somebody else, or just have him cash in and have him lose. Not everybody has to win when they cash in. I know it would be a waste of the briefcase, but they wasted that fucking thing the moment they put it on him. So get it off him, and then pair him up with Barrett going forward, call him the European Union or something. I like that idea a hell of a lot better than Barrett teaming with Neville, because I just think that's death for Neville. We then got a Roman Reigns in-ring promo. Oh boy. Speaking of them never learning a thing. Whoever's idea it was to put this guy in the middle of the ring in Chicago for story time should never again be allowed to script a segment on this show. This was a disaster. He was out there to recap the last 6 years, or months, feels like years, of his feud with Bray Wyatt. The crowd started giving him the what treatment. He did the worst thing you could possibly do, which is let it get to you. He asked them, "Can't you hear me?" And the fans then chanted boring at him. He said, "This ain't boring, this is real life," which is a stupid thing to say. We all know this is not real life. There's absolutely nothing about this feud that feels real in any way, shape, or form. And that's the problem. You know, there isn't a single thing about today's WWE that screams real life or reality, which is why I laugh when people still call it the reality era. There never was a reality era. The closest thing to a reality era was the summer of 2011, and that didn't last very long. There is nothing real about anything that we see on this TV show. Nothing feels genuine. You know, they kind of started in that direction a little bit when they used Roman's daughter that one time, but then it was quickly dropped. So, this was awful. This was awful. Whatever progress they've made with Roman Reigns since WrestleMania, it felt in this one segment like they completely erased it in one night, sending him out there. And they do it in Chicago. You know what they need to do? I'm not even trying to be funny. I honestly mean this. Because it cannot be any worse than what they've done with him. When it comes to promos like this, it cannot be any worse. Having Roman Reigns say absolutely nothing and just make mean faces and then beat the crap out of people would be far better. Far better than sending him out there and putting a mic in his hand to recite this kind of stuff. And he's not a bad talker, you know, when they let him speak like a normal person, but they don't let him do it. So what I propose, something horrible happens to the Roman Reigns character. I don't know if Dean Ambrose turns on him. I would rather not. I would rather they keep the two of them together instead of splitting them up. But it has to be something horrible like that. Like when Rollins, you know, turned on his brothers. Whatever it is. Or maybe it happens at Hell in a Cell. He gets screwed out of the match somehow. It scars him so bad. It's almost like Sting back in 96. They could borrow Paige out of the Sting playbook. He just stopped talking one day, right? And he didn't speak for a year. I'm not saying it has to go for a year, but I'm telling you, it would be a hell of a lot more effective than what they're doing with him right now. He just doesn't speak. He becomes the silent ass kicker. And people try to get him to say something. They try to coax it out of him. He's in the ring. Maybe, you know, they're trying to bring him out for a promo, and he doesn't say anything. And he just walks off. Make the people want to hear from him. So that way, when he does finally speak, it's a big deal. That's what they should do. And yes, they'll have to stop airing all those PSAs with him talking about cancer and reading and anti-bullying and all that kind of crap. I'm sure they could find somebody else to do it for 6 months. It doesn't have to be Roman Reigns. He followed up the horrible promo with an 8-minute match against Braun Strowman. They must really have had it out for this fucker on this show. Reigns won by countout when he gave Strowman a Superman punch out on the floor, sent the big man falling backwards over the announce desk. So Reigns wins by countout. Ryback squashed Rusev in 3 minutes with the shell shock, the most decisive win that anybody has ever had over Rusev since he debuted. And ironically, it came in a week where TMZ broke the news that Rusev and Lana are engaged. Apparently, The actual engagement proposal happened about a month ago. Lana posted a photo on her social media accounts of her in bed with Rusev, flashing the rock on her finger. TMZ picked it up and they ran with it. Vince McMahon was said to not be happy about the whole thing, even though they had to be working with TMZ because they were plugging this. Like, they've given stories to TMZ before to break because, oh, it's TMZ, it's a big deal. And then Michael Cole on TV won't shut up about it. They basically were doing the same thing here, and they kept plugging TMZ over and over again. So there had to be some kind of collusion here. They had to leak it to them or whatever happened. There was some level of cooperation, but it wasn't as though they wanted this to happen. Maybe WWE knew it was coming out, or it did come out, and they wanted to jump on it. But whatever the case may be, Vince McMahon was said to not be happy that this got out, which is understandable, given how much time they've invested in this storyline. I, on the other hand, cannot be happier that things turned out the way they did, because what it means, hopefully, is that this awful storyline is now over. Or at least, at the very least, they're now forced to go in a totally different direction with it if it isn't. But it looks like it is. Unfortunately for Rusev, it appears he's being punished for his sins. Not only, you know, jobbing to Ryback as quickly as he did, which to me is way too much of a coincidence. You cannot convince me this was just a coincidence that this happens, and there's reports that Vince is very unhappy, and Rusev loses. He's jobbed out as quickly as he's ever been. There is no coincidence there. So not only did that happen, but immediately after, Summer Rae, who had just proposed to Rusev on TV the week before, absolutely tore him to shreds, called him a selfish bastard, slapped him across the face, and walked off. Just completely castrated this guy in front of the world. And it sure seemed like the end of the storyline to me in watching that. Now, I have to get something off my chest about the Rusev stuff. There's been some debate about whether or not Lana and Rusev are in the wrong here for what happened. For the people who think this is just another sign that kayfabe is dead and that's what's killing WWE, no. No. Let me tell you what's killing WWE. A lack of competition is killing WWE. Incompetent booking is killing WWE. An inability to create new stars is killing WWE. 3 fucking hours of bad television every week, that's what's killing WWE. Kayfabe, way down on the list. Is it on there? Yeah, maybe it's on there, but it's way down on the list. Doesn't even make the top 5. And if Vince McMahon is that angry about what happened here, if he's that upset, if the company is punishing Rusev over it, and it's only been 1 week, right? So by the time a lot of you guys listen to this, there'll be another episode of Raw in the books, the go-home show to Hell in a Cell, and we'll see. We'll see what they have Rusev doing tomorrow night. I see already there are reports online that Rusev is in for a quote-unquote interesting day. That's what the Wrestling Observer said. An interesting day. I have no idea what that means, but it doesn't sound good. So we'll see. But if they are punishing him for it, they need to look in the mirror. You lose the right to complain when two of your top executives, Vince McMahon's own daughter, on her Twitter page, in her bio, go on there right now. In her bio, she has the line, "I play a bad guy on TV." It's right there on her page. "I play a bad guy on TV." Her husband, Triple H, on his own Twitter page, as part of his bio, it says, "Whether in the office or playing a bad guy on TV." And you're going to blame Lana for posting a picture of her engagement ring? You can't have it both ways. You can't talk out of both sides of your mouth like that. I'm cool with doing it either way, personally. Okay, you want to keep kayfabe off camera? Fine. Then wipe that shit off your profile and tell everybody on the roster you need to stay in character. At least on social media, you need to stay in character. You just had a photo go up last night from backstage at one of the shows on the Mexico tour that they're on. It's Chris Jericho, Roman Reigns, Bray Wyatt, Sheamus, Cesaro, the Matadors, unmasked, with one of them flipping the bird. And Luke Harper, who's wearing a towel for some reason, I don't want to even think about why. All of them are wearing Harper Yeah 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 shirts. He's got his own shirt now. It's awesome. It's an awesome photo. But there's Roman Reigns and Bray Wyatt standing right next to each other, smiling, they're flexing their biceps. After sitting through Roman on Monday night trying to convince the crowd, this is real life. You know, the stuff between him and Bray, this is real life. Now, it doesn't bother me. Like I said, this photo, I don't care. It looks like they were having fun. But if WWE has a problem with Lana and Rusev doing it, and they may be punished for it in some way, then don't be hypocrites. Punish every single one of those guys in that photo. Hey, I mean, at least be consistent with it. So do you think they're going to do that? You think they're going to punish Bray and Roman and Jericho? Of course not. Of course not. And it was Jericho who posted the photo. He was the one who posted it on his Instagram before he deleted it. And he's got more veteran experience than anybody else in that whole group. He's more old school than the rest of them. And he's the one who put the photo up. I don't know, maybe he was drunk off his ass on vodka. Who knows? Knowing him, he probably was. But this is nothing new. This is not some new phenomenon. I'm sure most of you have seen the photo before from the back of the tour bus on the European tour about 20 years ago. Of Undertaker and the Godwins and Kevin Nash and Shawn Michaels and Austin and Triple H. And I think X-Pac is in there. Paul Bearer, Gerald Briscoe. All in the back of the bus. They're all drinking. They're all smoking cigars. I guarantee you, if we had social media back then, that photo would have been all over the place. And people would have been complaining, oh, kayfabe is dead. Kayfabe is dead. Right? They did that with the curtain call in 96. Kayfabe is dead. But there was no social media, so we didn't hear about stuff like that. I mean, shit, the curtain call, we had the one piece of grainy video. That shit would have been all over YouTube. It would have been all over Twitter. But we didn't have this kind of stuff back then. There was no social media, so we didn't hear about it. But it's not like the guys were shy about being photographed together. We just see a lot more of it now because of Twitter and because of Instagram. It's just the nature of social media. And if WWE wants to round up the troops and lay down some ground rules, then go ahead and do it. But pick a side and stand by it. If not, don't get upset when something like this happens. And I know it's Triple H and Stephanie, and so that the same rules don't apply to them. They can have that shit up on their profiles. It's completely hypocritical. It's completely hypocritical. Total Divas. Look at Total Divas. Total Divas is an even more egregious example of breaking kayfabe. And blurring the lines between fantasy and reality. Their enemies on TV, and then 2 seconds later, they show you their best friends outside the ring. And that's a million people on television every week that watch that show. Tough Enough. Look at Tough Enough. You bring in the Big Show to chop people on TV, and half of them laugh and they no-sell it. And you're upset that Lana posted a picture on her Instagram? Shouldn't you be more upset about that? I didn't hear anybody complaining about that. I didn't hear reports that WWE was upset with ZZ and everybody else over that. To me, that exposes the wrestling business a hell of a lot more than this. So if you're going to be upset about Lana posting that picture, I praise Lana. Even if she didn't mean to do it, I praise her for putting a shank right in the back of this stupid storyline. We had Brie Mode and Alicia Fox beating the Divas champion Charlotte and Becky Lynch when Brie delivered a missile dropkick to Charlotte and pinned her after Charlotte was distracted by Paige, who was attacking Natalya outside the ring. Let me repeat that in case I wasn't clear enough. Brie Bella pinned Charlotte, the Divas champion, with a missile dropkick. I believe Charlotte's second loss in as many weeks. Divas Revolution indeed. Main event was Demon Kane against Seth Rollins in a lumberjack match. The best thing on the entire show is when they introduce the lumberjacks and out walks Big Show. And directly behind him is Big E. And Big E does the Big Show chokeslam hand gesture behind his back. It was so great. New Day I saw was also headbanging at ringside to Seth Rollins' music when he was introduced. Unfortunately, they didn't show that on TV. New Day is awesome. Crowd was dead for most of this match, and you know, on Monday night when I was flipping between the game and between Raw, I flipped onto this and I saw them in the middle. I saw Rollins and Kane in the middle of the ring, and I'm just thinking to myself, like, why is the crowd so dead? It's Chicago. Chicago is notoriously one of the better WWE crowds, and even Chicago, they broke Chicago. That's how bad this was. That's how long this show is and how bad it was. Crowd was dead for most of this. At one point, Kane and Big Show came face-to-face, and Big Show gave him the knockout punch. I am terrified that the reason they did this was to set up a Big Show versus Kane match for TV this week. I could see that, too. I could see Triple H and Stephanie punishing Kane by putting him in a match with the Big Show. Unfortunately, they're not just punishing Kane, they're punishing all of us. So hopefully that doesn't happen. I pray that I'm wrong. The heel Lumberjack started beating up on Kane, but he fought them all off and ended up tombstoning Rollins and pinning him, because of course Seth Rollins would be pinned. Yet another loss for the WWE World Heavyweight Champion. This week, they're loading up with legends to try to win back some of the viewers that have bailed on them. Ric Flair and Shawn Michaels are being advertised because when ratings are down, trot out the old dudes. That's what they're doing. Steve Austin was advertised, and then he wasn't. Then he was again. As late as Wednesday, they had his picture up on the website. They were saying that he would be live on Raw. Now he's not advertised again, other than him being there to do the podcast with Brock Lesnar. The Stone Cold Podcast with Brock is after the show this Monday night, and frankly, I'm looking a hell of a lot more forward to that than I am to Raw itself.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT, the synergy between NXT and Gabe Sapolsky's Evolve promotion continues with the announcement this week that Sami Zayn, who has been out recovering from shoulder surgery, he's still a few months away from coming back, would be appearing at the Evolve shows. Not wrestling, but appearing. They had two New York shows scheduled this weekend. One was last night. He came out, Sami did, after the main event, off the air, since I think it was an iPay-per-view and he couldn't be on the pay-per-view. So when they went off the air, Sami came out, he went in the ring, he cut a promo, he put over Johnny Gargano after Gargano's win against Ethan Page in their I Quit match. And then Gargano wrapped Sami Zayn in some streamers that people had thrown. It was, you know, a mutual admiration society in the ring, but nothing physical from Sami. I imagine tonight at the show, if he's there again, it'll be much of the same. But that's still, you know, that's a big deal. To see WWE working, you know, very publicly working with another promotion, an indie promotion, we haven't seen anything like this, maybe going back to the WWF-ECW relationship in the late 90s. That's how long it's been. They also had a feature up on WWE.com this week talking to Gabe, telling us which Evolve superstars we should keep an eye out for. They profiled Johnny Gargano, Anthony Nese, who was the guy that Bray Wyatt literally threw at Roman Reigns on Raw a few weeks ago. Zack Sabre Jr., who has been getting a lot of buzz, and a couple of other guys. They may as well hold up a sign that says, "They will be ours soon." I'm sure a lot of those guys will end up in NXT, especially, you know, Gargano's, he's already there, even if it isn't full-time, and I think Zack Sabre Jr. is one of those guys that is definitely on their radar and will inevitably end up at NXT. I don't see how he doesn't. They're also moving ahead, real quick here before we get to the review, they're moving ahead with that new NXT Kids show. I told you about this a few months ago. They had filmed a pilot that leaked online. I watched it before they pulled it. It had little kids hosting and doing commentary for some of the matches. I think I may have even made the comment that the commentary was better than the commentary we have on Monday nights. So I would totally be in favor of taking a bunch of 6- and 8-year-old kids and having them call Raw. Apparently this show may be used as a vehicle for Izzy, the Bayley superfan, which would mean that Izzy is getting a bigger push than Cesaro. Think about that. NXT this week opened with Bayley out to Chance of Match of the Year and You Deserve It after her Iron Man match with Sasha Banks. She talked about how the women of NXT have helped put women's wrestling back on the map. Which is funny, because when they were doing the intros for the Nia Jax match later in the show, I don't know how many of you picked up on this, but Greg Hamilton, the ring announcer, referred to it as a Divas match, which is something that only recently started, and I don't like that. I want them to stop. So Bayley was interrupted by the Dubstep Cowboys and Alexa Bliss. Bliss talked about how much she respected Bayley and wanted to congratulate her on her big win. She was doing it in the most sarcastic, insincere manner possible, and she swiped the title out of Bayley's hand. She ended up cutting a promo on her and saying that she wanted a shot at the championship. So that appears to be the next program, or at least a bridge for Bayley between now and whoever her opponent may be at the next takeover special. You know, maybe it'll be Alexa, or maybe in London they'll stick somebody else in there. I think it's probably way too early to do the Asuka Bayley match. I would save that for maybe closer to WrestleMania time. Maybe, you know, they'll have an NXT show in Dallas WrestleMania weekend. That could be the women's title match then. It could be Bayley and Asuka WrestleMania weekend. And if that's the case, I hope they do next year what they did not do this year. This year, I was at the NXT show in San Jose. It was awesome. You had 4,500 people in this auditorium going out of their minds. It was a great show, but they didn't air it on the network, and they actually have not aired it since. I would think maybe even months down the road they would have aired something. They never did. If they have another NXT show WrestleMania weekend, they need, whether it's a takeover or not, they need to air that on the network. And if I were them, I would save the Asuka Bayley match for then. They aired the video I talked about last week, backstage at TakeOver with Finn Balor and Samoa Joe, after they won the Dusty Classic. Joe said he wanted a shot at Finn's title. Finn was more than happy to oblige until William Regal said, no, 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 there would be a number one contender's battle royal to determine the new number one contender, which Joe was not happy about. He would not be very happy at the end of this show, either. We then got a flurry of backstage promos from some of the participants in the Battle Royal, kind of the way they sometimes do for the Royal Rumble. That's why I liked it. We heard from Ty Dillinger, Apollo Crews, Rhino, who reminded us that he was the last ECW champion. He looks exactly the same as he did when he won that title, I have to say. It's too bad the same can't be said for much of the rest of that original ECW roster, at least the ones that are still living. The Vaudevillains took on Sawyer Fulton and Angelo Dawkins in a non-title match. Feels like Dawkins has been repackaged like a dozen times since I first saw him on the show. And he never seems to gain any traction. I'm not sure why. I mean, he seems to have some personality, and he's a great athlete. He's obviously got talent. But whatever it was he was doing here with that mixing gesture, I've seen that once before. I assume that you all saw that. He kept motioning like he was mixing something. What the hell is that? What, is he baking a cake? Is he cooking meth? What is he doing? I don't know what that was all about, but he looked ridiculous doing it. Vaudevillains won with the Whirly Dervish. Devon Taylor, in perhaps her final ever backstage interview, although they taped four shows that night, so maybe not. Maybe she'll be on TV a couple more times, but it's too bad she never got her revenge on Dana Brooke for all those times that Dana was patting her on the head. Yeah, I kind of felt the same way about Kevin Kelly. You know, when Kevin Kelly left WWE, I always thought at some point, before he left, he was going to get his revenge on The Rock. For all those times The Rock would call him a hermaphrodite, and The Rock made him stick his own finger up his nose and embarrassed him on TV. Like, I knew at that time that Kevin Kelly was doing some managing on the indies, I think as a heel. I forgot what the promotion was. It was like the ECWA or something, some East Coast-based promotion. And Kelly was a performer. I don't know that he wrestled any matches. He might have, but I remember reading about him being a heel manager. And I thought, you know, hey, this could be a great angle. If Kelly's any good, like if he can talk, maybe even take a few bumps if he wants to do a match one day just have him turn on The Rock. You know, like he's not going to put up with his shit anymore. Maybe have him, you know, manage another heel. And it could make for an entertaining feud, but unfortunately, it never happened. Devin interviewed the Mechanics, Dash and Dawson. Pretty good promo. I haven't seen much of them on the microphone, but they gave them the chance here to talk, and I liked it, especially Dash Wilder. I thought he was very good. They talked about beating the Vaudevillains back in the Dusty Tag Team Classic, which should make them the new number one contenders, but for whatever reason, they apparently are going to be wrestling Kaz and Enzo next, so that's the next feud. It was finally time for the debut of Nia Jax. She is coming no longer. Now she is here. Her opponent was Evie from New Zealand, who has competed for the Shine and Shimmer promotions before under that same name. People online have raved about her work, and I think this may have actually been a tryout for Evie. I didn't see enough of her to really form an opinion, so I can't say, but I did see Nia Jax, and all I can say is this is not what I was expecting. I don't know what I was expecting exactly, but you know, not from those vignettes that they've been airing for the last 2 months. You know, you watch those and you expect this dark beast of a woman who just tears through everybody else that stands in her way. And maybe she will end up doing that, but between the music that she came out to and her gear, oh my God, that outfit, and her smiling, it just didn't seem to fit. You know, I don't know. I guess we all just misread what the character maybe was supposed to be. Maybe this was the plan all along. She did play the role of monster chick who can't be knocked down. Evie gave her a couple kicks and couldn't knock her down, and then she destroyed Evie in about 2 minutes, you know, with picked her up and slammed her down to the mat, almost like a spinebuster, a standing spinebuster. It's going to take a while for me to really get a feel for Nia Jax, but I want to say something here. Nia is a big woman, okay? She's bigger than the other women they have on the roster. She used to be a plus-size model, which a lot of people may not know. You know, she doesn't hide from it. She's posted throwback photos on her Twitter from her modeling days, so it's not something that she doesn't want people to know. She's a big girl, and she's proud of it. Sure enough, so predictable. Comment after comment after comment from our own Facebook page, mostly from other sites, but a little bit from our own Facebook page. Oh, she's fat. Look how fat she is. But, like, said in a way, like, why is there a fat girl on TV? As though everybody should look like Eva Marie. First of all, let me just say this. Enough with all the fat comments, okay? We get it. She's a big girl. She's not fucking Bull Dempsey, whose entire gimmick is that he's fat and out of shape and can't stop stuffing his face. Okay, that isn't her gimmick. We get it. She's a big girl. Enough. Now, her gear. I will say, her gear does not do her any favors. I don't know what that's all about. I don't know what's going on there. It's not very flattering, and she needs to change that ASAP. And I'm not just talking about how it looks. I mean, the colors, everything about it, it just, no. It just doesn't work. The first thing she needed to do as she walked back through the curtain was burn those clothes and find new ones. But I like the fact that we have somebody in that women's division. And this is part of why I like when Awesome Kong came in as Karma. And I was very excited when she came in, and then very disappointed because she never wrestled a match. She was in the Royal Rumble. She made a cameo in there. She beat up Dolph Ziggler. I don't think she ever had a proper match against the other women in WWE. Right? She got pregnant. She left. And I don't know what the hell happened with her after that. That thing is still a mystery to me, that just the way it went down, and she never came back. I think she ended up having a miscarriage. I don't know what happened, but I was excited when she came in because, first of all, she had the reputation as being a great wrestler. You don't really see it on Impact now because she's all hurt. She's got, like, a really bad back. She may need surgery. It's kind of sad, actually, to watch her now. That's not the Awesome Kong of old. The Awesome Kong of old was awesome, right? She could wrestle. She was a modern-day, you know, Aja Kong or Bull Nakano, that big, just monster of a woman who would just beat the crap out of you. And she was so different, especially then. And this goes back, I don't know how many years, 4 years now, 5 years? At that time, you had Michelle McCool, and you, I mean, everybody up and down that roster, they all looked the same. They all looked like Barbie dolls. Stick figure Barbie dolls, right? Stick figures with a blonde wig. And here comes Karma, and it's something different. And I think she would have gotten over big time, but she never had the chance. And so what I like about Nia Jax now is that she doesn't look like everybody else. Right, it's no different with the men. There was a period in WWE where everybody looked identical. Their bodies, their hair, their gear, everything about them was the same. They even had Dolph, I don't know if it was Dolph's choice or if they convinced him to do it. Dolph Ziggler, fucking, he dyed his hair brown. Right, he had the short cropped hair, he dyed it brown. He looked like Ted DiBiase. I'm like, we already have a Ted DiBiase. Why is Dolph Ziggler looking like Ted DiBiase? Thank God he went back to his old look. I mean, it looked like these guys were coming off a fucking assembly line. And for years, it was even worse with the women. Every woman had to look like a prostitute with big fake tits and enough collagen in her lips you could freaking use them as a flotation device. You know, after a while, you see the same thing over and over. It's not sexy. I'm sitting here watching wrestling every week with these hot-ass women, and I'm like, eh. I became desensitized to it because that's not sexy. It's boring. And now you've still got some women with big fake tits, don't get me wrong, and I'm not saying they look bad, but you've got women who actually look normal, too. They look normal and natural, you know, some might even say attainable, even if they're really not. But I think if you look at a girl like an Eva Marie, and you put her next to a Bayley or a Sasha Banks, both of whom I think are very pretty, right? But Eva Marie is all dolled up, she's this model, right? That's her background, that's where she comes from. And you put Sasha or Bayley especially next to her, I think part of the appeal, they say like girl next door. I think there's a lot to that because I think you look at two girls like that and you've got wrestling fans who will say, you know, well, Bayley or Sasha, these are girls that are a hell of a lot more attainable than an Eva Marie. And so they like them more. There is something to be said for that. I'm not saying that applies to everybody, but when you think about why a girl like Eva Marie gets shitted on so much, and Bayley and Sasha, they're getting chants and they're being given flowers and everybody is all up their ass, you know, there's a reason for that. And that's part of it. These are normal, natural-looking, beautiful women that they have now on the roster. Very different than the way the women's roster used to look, because that was the look they were going for. And I can't tell you how many women were coming up in the OVW system at the time, you know. What was her face? Jillian Hall is one of them. If you go back and look at old photos of Jillian Hall, who had a ton of work done, okay, you can just look at the before and after. I thought, you know, Jillian Hall was a good-looking woman, you know, she was a beautiful girl. And then she had the implants put in. And look, I don't know if they had somebody in developmental who flat-out told these women, you need to go do this, you need to go away, you need to get the implants and come back. Or if it was, you know, kind of like they talk about the period of WWF back in the late 80s or early 90s, where even if somebody didn't tell you to get on the juice or get on the gas or whatever, it was kind of implied that, hey, maybe you should, or you're looking kind of small, that kind of thing. However it was approached. I look at a woman like that who looked completely different, and then she had the implants put in and she had this work done on her face. And I'm sure she's a nice girl, but I look at her after and I'm like, what happened? You know what I mean? Like, she was fine the way she was before, and then she had all this work done, and I'm like, eh. Like, this is not even the same person anymore. But that was that was kind of the unwritten rule in WWE, at least at one time, at least when it came to your chest. Every woman was having it done. There were very few exceptions. I mean, I could think of a couple, like Stacy Keibler. You know, that's why I love Stacy Keibler so much. She was a naturally beautiful woman. She didn't have to have the biggest rack in the world. She had so many other things going for her, and she was a star. She didn't need all those other things to be a star. She was a naturally just beautiful woman. And so here we are now in this period of WWE where you have, again, you have more women on that roster that just look normal and natural, and some of them are petite and some of them have more meat on their bones. You look at a girl like Paige. 10 years ago, she wouldn't have gotten a look from WWE, let alone been signed. You know, even now, I could just see Vince McMahon looking at Paige and not getting it, not having any idea what the appeal is. She's pale and she's got a funny accent. What's wrong with these people? And yet Paige is the darling of almost everybody online. Now it's Sasha Banks, and rightfully so. But Paige is by far one of the most popular divas. By far. That would have been unfathomable in this company a decade ago. So, you know, they're making progress in that way. Bayley also. Bayley is not a Victoria's Secret model, but she doesn't need to be. I don't want her to be. I think Bayley is perfect the way she is. And quite frankly, I find Bayley a hell of a lot more attractive than I do a lot of the other women they trot out there for their diva searches over the years. You know, most of those women, okay, hot as they are, they couldn't sell ice to an Eskimo. But a girl like Bayley, if WWE plays its cards right, she can make them a ton of money. She could be huge. So as far as Nia Jax goes, you know, I'm not sold yet on whatever it is that she's supposed to be, but I couldn't care less how big she is. And there are still people who are making a big deal about this, and they're mocking her, and some of the things they're saying, you know, look, Vince McMahon might care. I don't know what the hell's going to happen if they ever call her up to the main roster. Okay, Triple H is the one who brought her into NXT, and whatever plans Triple H has for his NXT people, things change when you get called up to the main roster. So could I see her being called up and a Vince McMahon or a Kevin Dunn looking at her and, you know, turning her physical appearance into a storyline? Wouldn't be the first time they've done that. Yeah, I could see that. The only thing I think that might save her is the fact that she's related to The Rock. I think she's cousins with The Rock. So she may get a pass because of that. I don't know that they would beat up on her too badly because of that. But again, this is the same company that made storylines out of Molly Holly having a big ass and Natalya farting. They gave her a farting gimmick, which tells you what they thought of Natalya's sex appeal. Because there's a snowball's chance in hell they'd have given that gimmick to somebody like Eva Marie or Kelly Kelly. We got a pre-taped promo from Eva Marie, speak of the devil, in Paris. She was over there taping stuff for Total Divas. It may be the last time we see Eva Marie after her battle with Asuka the other night. They had Asuka wrestle Eva Marie at one of the NXT house shows in Florida. No word yet on whether or not she survived. I guess if we get a 10-bell salute on Raw tomorrow night, I guess we'll know. You want to teach this girl how to wrestle. You know what? Instead of sticking her in the ring to practice with Brian Kendrick, okay, talented as he may be, stick her in the ring with Asuka for a few months. That'll smarten her up. We had the Battle Royal to determine a new number one contender for the NXT Championship. Tyler Breeze, by far, the most over guy in this match. Lots of let's go Tyler chants down the stretch. By the way, there was a story on UpRocks this week about Tyler Breeze quietly being moved up to the main roster. That story is not true. I don't know where they got that from, but he's been booked on some of the main roster house shows, which is true, but he's wrestled on those house shows before. There's absolutely no indication it means that he's been permanently moved, which is kind of what the story said. I sure as hell hope not. I have no faith they would know what to do with this guy. Plus, he deserves to win the NXT title before he does get that eventual call-up. Yeah, I keep saying Tyler Breeze, always a bridesmaid, never a bride. The guy, through it all, is still over. He's a hell of a performer. I'm still digging the gimmick. And all these other guys, whether it's Sami Zayn, Kevin Owens, Finn Balor, they've all held the championship. They've all kind of reached that level. And I feel he deserves to as well. Because you know what? I hate to say it, but once he does get called up, him winning the NXT title may be the highlight of his career. You know, aside from him one day getting a WrestleMania moment, which I'm sure will be a big deal for him. But that could be the pinnacle that this guy reaches. And so he deserves to have that moment. And from the sounds of it on this show, I think Full Sail would agree. Baron Corbin and Rhino, who were once enemies, and then they became partners in the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic, they worked together for much of this match. And remember that, because that's important. I'm going to come back to that. Apollo Crews at one point hurled Johnny Gargano out of the ring onto the other three guys that Crews had just eliminated, which was a cool spot. Tommaso Ciampa was in there as well. He was dumped out by Samoa Joe later on. The Mechanics, Dash and Dawson, they dumped out Colin Cassidy. And then right after that, Enzo Amore snuck up behind him, and he dumped out both Dash and Dawson all by himself to a big pop. And almost immediately after that, Enzo was eliminated by Ty Dillinger. Came down to the final four. Baron Corbin, Tyler Breeze, Samoa Joe, and Apollo Crews. Joe literally kicked Breeze right out of the ring, which the crowd at Full Sail was not happy about. They serenaded Samoa Joe with boos. First time that Samoa Joe has really been booed since coming to NXT. That's how much love the people have for Tyler Breeze. So Joe's in there. He's on fire. He gets Baron Corbin up for the muscle buster. Corbin slips out, sends Joe over the top rope, but Joe lands on the apron. At which point, Tyler Breeze, who had not yet left ringside, pulls Joe off the apron, yanks him right down to the floor. And this got loud thank you Tyler chants, which was amazing. Samoa Joe gets eliminated, and the person who eliminated him gets thank you chants from the crowd. So how quickly the crowd can turn on you. Came down to Baron Corbin and Apollo Crews. And I would have been perfectly fine with either one of these guys winning. The last 2 or 3 minutes with these guys was damn good. You can't watch this and watch his last two takeover matches and not see the improvement that Baron Corbin has made from even 6 months ago. He tries to toss Apollo Crews out of the ring a whole bunch of times. Every single time, Crews lands on the apron. Crews ends up getting Corbin in position for his standing moonsault, but Corbin got the knees up. He then tries to finish off Apollo, but Apollo hits him with a couple of kicks, and then he clotheslines Corbin out of the ring for the win. So Apollo Crews is your new number one contender. I enjoyed that Battle Royal a lot. As Battle Royals go, I thought it was one of the better ones I've seen on a WWE show in a long, long time. A big part of what I liked about it is something that made the 1992 Royal Rumble match so special, and I know there's your obligatory 92 Rumble mention. You knew it was coming. But this is actually high praise. You guys know how I feel about that match, and there was something about that 92 Rumble that I saw here. This match had at least three different stories going on, right? It wasn't just a random battle royal thrown together. First of all, it had a purpose. It was a number one contenders match. But you have three different stories going on at once. Joe feeling entitled to that next title shot, going for the win. Tyler Breeze ends up screwing him out of his opportunity, which I would imagine now leads to a feud between the two of them. Baron Corbin eliminating Rhino, which he did, He's been tagging with Rhino recently. They were working together for much of the match. And then, just as Sid Justice showed Hulk Hogan in 92, it's every man for himself, brother. And you have Apollo Crews winning the match, which sets up a fresh challenger and a fresh storyline for Finn Balor. I also like the fact that I wasn't entirely sure who was going to win. I stayed away from the spoilers. I figured Joe, getting the next title shot, he'd probably win. But I wasn't 100% sure. I found myself pulling for Tyler Breeze, much like everybody else. And when he got dumped, I said, well, all right, I guess it's Joe. And then he got dumped. And it came down to Corbin and Crews, which could have gone either way, and I would have been fine. I would have been totally fine if Baron Corbin would have won, and it would have made sense. Finn Balor against the big heel. I would have been fine with that. I've really warmed up to Corbin. He's finding his groove as a heel. And Crews, obviously, he's an incredible performer. To the people asking, and people have asked, is it too much too soon for Apollo Crews? Let me give you two words. Kevin Owens. Kevin Owens debuted, and later that same night, he beat up the new champion. 2 months later, he won the belt. I didn't see people complaining about that, right? Apollo Crews, he debuted at the Brooklyn show in August. So he's already been around for about 2-3 months. If it's fine for Kevin Owens, it's fine for Apollo Crews. And I was not bothered at all by the push they gave to Kevin Owens. I was okay with it because the guy's fucking great at what he does. We need more people like Kevin Owens on that roster. I bet you there were a lot of people in WWE. There may still be people in WWE on that main roster who look at a guy like Kevin Owens and are scratching their heads why he's over. I've heard he's selling merchandise. Why is this guy selling merchandise? Why is this guy so popular? I don't get it. Look at him, right? I bet you there are people on the roster still thinking that. Because he's really, 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 really good. That's why. And he's different. He's not the same cookie cutter that you would find elsewhere on the roster. He doesn't look like a WWE guy. That's why it works. Apollo Crews is more in line, I think, with what Vince McMahon would love, right? He's not tall, but he's big, right? He's big, he's muscular, he's black. Don't think that doesn't help him, because it does. You hear stories about WWE looking for its next big Latin star. Believe me, Vince McMahon would love to have a big black star and a big Hispanic star. He'd love to cover all the different groups so that he can make as much money off them as possible. And Apollo Crews is going to get every opportunity. I mean, look, Apollo Crews is going to be WWE champion one day. I don't doubt that for a second. He may not be NXT champion. Depends how long they keep him down there for. If he's down there for any length of time, he'll win the belt. But maybe they'll call him up in the next couple of months. I hope not. But if they do, I don't doubt for a second that this guy right here is championship material. He doesn't just look the part. He's a great wrestler. He's a flashy guy. He can do things that a guy his size should not be able to do. This guy is everything Vince McMahon should love. And I'm sure Vince can't wait to get his hands on him. But the one thing I will say about Apollo Crews, and I said this in my TakeOver review last week, he's going to have to tone down some of the smiley stuff, because if he keeps doing it, the crowd is going to turn on this guy something fierce. Okay? I mean, they'll turn on Samoa Joe just because he dumped out Tyler Breeze. Don't think for a second that they wouldn't turn on this guy, because every time he comes out, he's flashing that grin, he's flashing those pearly whites. He keeps doing that, it's going to rub people the wrong way. Maybe not at Full Sail. Maybe they won't turn on him there. Maybe it's when he makes the main roster. But the overly smiley babyface newcomer, I don't care how talented he is, it always backfires. There's nothing new on the TNA front this week except for this. I mentioned this at the beginning of the show. The week before last, they announced that they had canceled their Hardcore Halloween tour at the end of the month due not to poor ticket sales, but to what TNA told PW Insider at the time were logistical changes internally. Okay, that was the official explanation. And they said, the wrestlers would get partial pay for the tour, so half a peanut instead of a whole peanut. TNA was said to be very happy with ticket sales up to that point, but because of internal logistics, they had to cancel it. Now, if that sounds like they're full of shit, it's because they are full of shit. If it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, it's a fucking duck. Here's the real reason why the tour was canceled. They announced that cancellation on October 9th, okay? On October 5th, 4 days before, I got an email from my source at Ticketmaster as a follow-up to some earlier TNA house show numbers he had emailed me about. And he said that they had only sold 103 tickets for their October 29th show in Louisiana. It's at the Harang Auditorium. I looked it up. Building has a capacity of 3,500, okay? This is part of the tour. This show was on the 29th. It was scheduled to be part of their Halloween tour. 39 orders they pulled for a total of 103 tickets. That's what they had sold up to that point, only a few weeks before the show. 4 days after he emailed that to me, they canceled the entire tour because of quote-unquote internal logistics. So I guess internal logistics is now the code word for, oh shit, nobody's coming to our shows. So yeah, I wanted you guys to get the real story on why these shows were canceled. Anybody with half a brain when they heard that official explanation could have figured they're full of shit. They probably didn't sell any tickets, but there's some concrete numbers for you. At least for the show on the 29th. I would imagine the other ones were looking just as bad, so they decided to just scrap the entire thing, but now you know. I didn't have a chance to watch Ring of Honor yet. I'm a little behind, so I can't review the show this week, but there are some Lucha Underground notes I want to get to here real quick. Alberto El Patron, there's some reports out there that he may possibly, it's not official, but he may possibly be done with Lucha Underground, may not appear on a second season. It was reported in the Observer this week that he was not happy about a number of things. He was not happy that he was not featured as the main event of the Ultima Lucha special, or that he was not featured as the top guy with the promotion. WWE is said to have interest in bringing him back, but he may be leaning more towards TNA, which has the limited schedule. It would allow him to continue working for AAA down in Mexico. You know, of course they have a limited schedule. You know, they have no schedule. Who wouldn't want to work for one company while drawing a paycheck from another one that doesn't run any shows? So I can't say I blame him for that. But that's where things stand with him. Potentially done with Lucha Underground, possibly on his way to TNA. WWE does have interest in him. They're still looking for that big Latin star. You know, here's the thing, though. I don't sense anybody clamoring to see Alberto Del Rio back in WWE. I mean, are you interested? Are you that interested in seeing him back in WWE? I don't get the sense that there's a whole lot of interest in seeing this guy come back, or that if he comes back, he's going to be presented any differently than he was the last time we saw him. He had his moments, but once they turned him babyface, which happened like overnight, and he had a little bit of momentum maybe at first, but then it just fell off a cliff. It just didn't work. He's a great wrestler. And I actually enjoyed, you know, how he was used in Lucha Underground. He wasn't on the show every week, which always makes a person seem that much fresher when they're not, you know, shoved down your throat every single week. But I thought, you know, how they were using him there was fine. I can't say even in Lucha Underground he was my favorite performer. You know, he wasn't. So maybe I'm in the minority here. I don't get the sense that I am. I just don't sense that clamoring for him to come back to WWE. And if he does, I really don't see him being that much of a difference maker. You know, he's had his time. He was there for a number of years. He was established. He was a main event guy. He won a bunch of championships. He was world champion. He was WWE champion. He won a Royal Rumble. I mean, if you look back, he was pretty damn successful. I mean, if anything, he overachieved. I mean, given how over or not over he seemed to be, he should have been a hell of a lot more over than he was. And it just wasn't the case. So whatever he ends up doing, I mean, look, if he ends up back in WWE, I guess that's a feather in their cap, but I don't see anything being any different than it was before. And I just don't sense that people are all that interested in seeing him back. The other thing is WWE is apparently interested in two other Lucha Underground names. Ricochet, who of course in Lucha Underground is Prince Puma, and Angelico, who is absolutely out of his mind doing all the balcony dives, but I became a huge Angelico fan. I became a huge fan of the Angelico, Son of Havoc, Ivelisse trio. I thought they were great. I hope that continues into season two. As far as Ricochet goes, you know, Ricochet had a tryout a couple years ago for WWE and blew everybody away, and they didn't sign him because supposedly the rationale at the time was, well, we have enough guys that look like him. We have enough guys of that size. We've kind of reached our quota of small guys. which is so stupid. You have a guy like Ricochet who's trying out. You have a guy like Ricochet who practically falls in your lap. There are very few people in wrestling with as much talent as this guy has, and you pass on him because, well, we have enough small guys. It's such a ridiculous... And look, obviously they're thinking twice about that now because they're bringing in all these indie guys. They've got Johnny Gargano on NXT, for crying out loud, and Johnny Gargano smaller than Ricochet. So things have changed. Now they're more open. And supposedly their plan would be to bring him in and fast-track him right into a feud for the NXT title with Finn Balor. That sounds incredible. But if I'm Ricochet, unless they're offering me a lot of money, you know, I'm like, you know what? I got a good thing going on over here. I think I'll pass. Because he does. You know, he's got a great thing going with Lucha Underground. I think he's first starting to get back into Japan. He's going to be booked over there, I think, for New Japan. It's not like he's hurting for work. If WWE blows him away with this great money offer, I guess he'd be a fool not to take it. And frankly, if I'm them, I'm offering him, you know, what he deserves. There are some guys in NXT who have, you know, better deals than the average NXT star would. A lot of those guys in NXT, you know, from everything I've heard, they don't make a lot of money. They don't make great money. But then you got a guy like a Samoa Joe or maybe a James Storm who gets a better deal. Those are guys that have special deals. To me, Ricochet, even if you brought him in full-time and he was just going to be a WWE guy, you know, you got to pay that guy what he's worth. And to me, he's one of the best performers in the entire wrestling business right now. And if anything, I think him wearing the Prince Puma mask is actually limiting him. I think it's limiting what he's capable of. Because we don't hear him speak. We've never heard Prince Puma say a single word on Lucha Underground. So the mask kind of, it prevents him from speaking and from expressing his personality. But I also think with a guy like that, and I could see maybe why WWE would have the interest in him for this reason as well, he's not a bad-looking guy at all. So you put a mask on him, you know what I mean? You're taking away like half the guy's appeal. I think the guy could appeal to women. You know, he's the kind of guy that you would put, you know, front and center on a poster. You know, he could be the poster boy for your promotion. So I actually think in Lucha Underground, he's very limited. I think it's limiting what this guy is capable of. And if he came to WWE, you know, he ain't going to be wearing a mask. So it'd be very interesting to see what happens. I know with Lucha Underground, these guys are signed to 7-year contracts. So, I mean, that doesn't mean that Lucha Underground wouldn't let him go. If you know, he got a really great offer. You know, I know somebody like a Gabe Sapolsky has in the past let guys out of their contract, let's say, from Evolve if there's interest from WWE, because he knows. You know, he knows that they can make more money and they could kind of make it to the next level. He's not going to stop them from doing that. Lucha Underground is a completely different beast. You know, it's not a promotion so much. It's a television show. It's got some big money behind it. They've got these 7-year contracts. I don't even know if he can get out of it. You know, he may be locked down for many, many more years to come. This all may be a moot point. But WWE definitely has him and Angelico on their radar. Time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to me. As always, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please do not forget to include your name and where you are from. Kevin from Baltimore. I think Gabe Sapolsky has been active in pro wrestling, wearing substantially more hats than other bookers, for a long enough time that it's not unfair to judge his career and impact on the business. I think he was extremely effective at grounding the focus of indie wrestling after the churn and burn of ECW in the Attitude Era, and I'm amazed he was able to juggle the booking responsibilities of ROH, Florida, and I think Shimmer all at the same time. Shine. I think it was actually Shine he's affiliated with, not Shimmer. I don't know if he can be held responsible at all for the spate of no-sell, high-spot shenanigans that coincided with his tenure, though. Maybe it's just easier for wrestlers and audiences to react to actions rather than emotions these days. What do you think about Gabe Sapolsky? Well, you forgot to also mention Evolve and Dragon Gate, USA. So, yeah, I mean, Gabe's been involved in a lot of different projects. Now he's got this agreement going with NXT. I think Gabe Sapolsky is a smart guy. I've never met him personally. He seems to have a great mind for wrestling. He seems to love wrestling. I mean, he goes all the way back to the ECW days. You know, he was basically Paul Heyman's apprentice. He worked underneath Heyman. Heyman obviously thinks the world of him because when there was talk, probably about 5 years ago now, of Heyman meeting with Dixie Carter, which he admits he did do. He did meet with Dixie. about possibly running things in TNA. I don't know if Heyman's ever said this publicly, but the rumors at the time were that one of Heyman's plans, he had all these plans of what he was going to do when he took the reins. And one of his plans was to bring in Gabe to help him on the booking side. So, I mean, can you imagine if Dixie Carter had handed Paul Heyman the keys back then and you had Paul and Gabe working together in TNA, how different things might be today? I mean, look, you know, Gabe ran ROH for all those years, and it's not like ROH got a big TV deal out of it or anything, but TNA at the time already had national television. They already had some big names like Kurt Angle and a bunch of homegrown guys underneath like Styles and Joe and Daniels and Rude. So imagine Heyman and Gabe being handed all of that, you know, with a TV deal, booking all those guys. But anyway, he seems like a smart guy. Most of the things I've heard said about him from the guys that have actually worked for him, they speak very highly of their time working under him. Not a lot of bad words said about the way he does business, which is part of the reason why, you know, Triple H is working with the guy. Triple H is not going to work with some random scumbag indie promoter with a bad rep. Right, they obviously think the world of him as well, because they wouldn't be doing business with him if they didn't. And that's a big deal. I said earlier, I can't remember the last time that WWE had this kind of an agreement going with basically an indie promotion. Probably going back to the ECW days in the late 90s when they were working together. And so that tells you right there at least what they think about Gabe Sapolsky. You know, he doesn't have this reputation as somebody who you wouldn't want to work for, or that doesn't have any idea what he's doing. And a ton of guys that he's brought in and built around, they ended up becoming very big names in WWE. In fact, one of them right now is the WWE champion. And those names have helped create the buzz that you now see with NXT. I think Triple H recognized that, and that's why he's doing business with him now and not Dixie Carter or Joe Koff with Ring of Honor and you know, one of the gazillion other indie promoters out there. John from California, I was listening back to Sound Off 230 back in July of 2012 in your review of Raw 1000. One of the things I forgot that you mentioned on the Daniel Bryan AJ Lee wedding is that you were hoping that would be the debut of Dean Ambrose interrupting the wedding, and that AJ would end up with Ambrose, since AJ said she was saying yes to another proposal, which instead turned out to be Vince McMahon, who came out and named her the new Raw GM. My question is, if indeed that did happen, would there be a Shield by the end of the year? And if so, if they still went with the idea of Rollins and Reigns together, who do you think would have filled the Dean Ambrose spot as the third man at that time? You know, it's funny you reminded me. I completely forgot I had pitched that idea, and looking back on it, I mean, you know, things turned out well. I'm happy that we got the Shield the way we did at the end of 2012, but that would have been a hell of an idea too, which is why I pitched it. The idea that Ambrose would have showed up and he would have ended up with AJ, I think they would have made, you know, in some ways, it kind of reminds me maybe of what Edge and Lita were. They wouldn't have been allowed to kind of take it as far as Edge and Lita did, because that was pre-PG. But I think a Dean Ambrose-AJ Lee combo could have turned out to be very interesting. And I'm also not sure that CM Punk would be married to AJ Lee right now, because when you put two people like that together in wrestling, more often than not, they end up together. So that probably would have changed the course of everything. But as far as the Shield goes, I think the third person obviously would have ended up being Cassius Ohno, Chris Hero. I mean, I think CM Punk, he had even talked about this, how he had, I think, pitched the idea originally for the Shield. They were going to be his guys. I think he talked about this on the podcast with Colt Cabana, and how he wanted it to be Rollins and Ambrose and Chris Hero. And it was WWE's idea to go with Roman Reigns instead. And so Chris Hero kind of got the shaft on that. So to me, if it wasn't Ambrose, it probably would have ended up being Hero. I can't think of anybody else at that time who was a name who was coming up in developmental who would have been a good fit for something like that, other than him. Matt from Toronto. I, like you, am a big Tyler Breeze fan. I love his work on NXT and watching him grow and develop the character. I also love your idea for there to be some kind of mid-card title for him in NXT, because he could totally own that. I've thought extensively about what he could do on the main roster when he eventually gets called up, and I see a natural fit for him pairing up with The Miz, the Hollywood A-lister and an internationally acclaimed model, simply works as a duo. I do wonder if this kind of pairing would help or hurt Breeze in the long run, but in the short term, it could be a fun act. You could even have them expand their entourage and have a stable called the A-list. Would love to hear your thoughts on this. It's not a bad idea. It actually, it could work. I don't like it because The Miz is just poison right now. The Miz is so far down on the totem pole. And for Tyler Breeze to come in and immediately be associated with failure is not my idea of trying to get this guy over. I think putting him with The Miz tells people right away this guy is not important. Because The Miz is not an important character on the show. He's more of a talk show host. He does more hosting of his Miz TV segments than he does actually wrestling matches. You know, could they be another team to throw in there in the tag team division? Yeah, but again, you're immediately slotting Tyler Breeze so far down on the card, you may as well just keep him in NXT. Feely from Houston. Becky Lynch is the only member of the Four Horsewomen to not hold the NXT Women's title. Not only that, but after Bayley, I really don't know who's next to deserve the title when she's gone. Should Becky return and win the title? Asuka can, but she just got to NXT. Do you know somebody else that can hold the titles standard? Other than maybe Emma? Honestly, no. I don't think there is anybody else like that right now on the NXT roster, at least as far as the women goes. I'd be all for Becky coming back with the idea that she's never held that title before and she wants it, like it eats her alive inside. She can't stand the fact that she's the only one of them not to have it. That could be the story right there. And it's not like they're doing much with her on the main roster. You know my thoughts on that. So I'm all for bringing Becky back if that's the story and adding another woman back to the roster down there. Matt from Florida. Does it bother you at all that Kevin Owens wrestles in basketball shorts and a t-shirt with the sleeves cut off? Years ago, fans would make fun of guys for competing in the indies with gear like that. Now we have a guy on the main roster dressing like this. To me, it just comes off as sloppy and amateurish. What are your thoughts? Well, I mean, what would you prefer? You know, would you prefer that he wear a singlet like he used to? Because that looks pretty amateurish to me. I don't think that's a good look for him. Nor is wrestling without a shirt. I don't think you want that either. Or maybe you do. I mean, hey, you know, to each their own. I'm not judging. But I have no problem with it. It works for him. That's the best thing I could say. That look would not work for anybody else. That look would not work for someone, say, like Cesaro. Okay? I don't think Cesaro walking out there in a cutoff shirt and basketball shorts would work. But Cesaro, he's built like a freaking brick wall, this guy. So, you know, he comes out there and his look works for him. Up until recently, he wasn't even wearing knee pads or elbow pads. I mean, he was old school. Cesaro was just tights and boots and that's it. And that works for him. For Kevin Owens, this is the look that works best for him. And I have no problem with it. Chris from Green Bay, Wisconsin. If you could go back in time and be in the crowd for any pay-per-view, which one would you pick? I think I may have mentioned this before, but because I could have actually been at this show, I've been to shows in that building many times before, and I'm still kicking myself that I didn't go. I would go with that first ECW One Night Stand pay-per-view that WWE did about 10 years ago at the Hammerstein Ballroom. One of the most fun shows I've ever watched. And I'm a WWE fan more than I ever was an ECW fan. I was never really a huge fan of the original ECW. But just to be in that crowd, just for that alone, when the Sandman came out to do his entrance, I mean, that was one of the most fun things I think I've ever seen on a WWE show ever. And it was the Sandman's entrance. You know, pretty bare bones. There wasn't much to it. But it was just so much fun. That whole show from top to bottom, that's one of the few shows I can go back and watch. Preferably the unedited version, because it's not the same with all the edits and the music taken out. They've kind of neutered it, but I can go back and watch that show at any time, start to finish, and not get bored. It was so much fun. And just the idea I could have been there for it and I wasn't, I'm still beating myself up over it. So that would be the show. Mike from Ardsley, New York. My question is this. Let's say that after the end of Hulk Hogan's WWF run, it was the end of his wrestling career. He never went to WCW and he never had a WWE comeback. Would he be recognized as being as big of a legend as he is today? I think the question really comes down to whether or not you think the work he did in WCW cemented him as a legend or just added to what he already accomplished in the WWF. Well, I mean, I'll give you my short answer first, is that absolutely. I mean, he would have been a legend. He would have been one of the all-time greats. And the WCW stuff absolutely just added on to his career. I mean, that NWO turn in 96 added at least 5 years to his career. And it made him relevant for that much longer. But without it, it's not as though he would be looked at, you know, a few levels down from a John Cena or a Steve Austin or a Rock. I mean, he would still be up there in that conversation. I mean, he, you know, talk about Mount Rushmore of most famous champions or biggest draws or whatever you want to call it. Hogan would still be on that. He'd still be on that mountain. You know what I mean? He'd still be up there. I think there's a lot of comparisons to be made between Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair in that respect, because Ric Flair had a very long career, you know, mostly in the NWA / WCW. He was the world champion. He was the guy. He was a heel for the most part. Hogan was a babyface, but, you know, Flair was in there with all the top names, from Terry Funk to Dusty Rhodes to Ricky Steamboat, Sting, who he helped make, all these different guys. Harley Race, obviously, he won the title from him, but Flair, if he had retired after that title win over Vader at Starrcade in 93, which I think would have been the perfect time for him to retire. I mean, if he just wanted to go out on a high note. Obviously, we got a lot of great Ric Flair moments after that, but I'm just saying, if you wanted to go out, the perfect moment for him to go out on would have been that Vader match. Because the build-up to that Vader match and the match itself, it was great. And it was in the Carolinas. He was the hometown hero. He won the championship back. It was a great moment if he would have stepped away. And he was already, you know, getting up there in age at that point. Talk about a storybook ending for a career. If he had done that, Flair still would have been regarded as one of the greatest of all time. And I think by staying active for too long, and I mean, you can argue what too long is. I'm not saying that by 1994 he was, you know, it was too long. I could say by the late 90s or 2000, you know, maybe it was too long. But by overstaying his welcome, and the same goes for Hogan, by staying for too long, I think the both of them tarnished their legacies. Because if you look at the ends of their careers, I mean, Flair had the moment with Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 24, but then he came back, he went to TNA. He really shouldn't have done that. I mean, I know why. He needed a paycheck, so he went to TNA. He could have gone to TNA to be a mouthpiece and not wrestle, but he opted to wrestle. And it was just sad. I mean, it was just sad watching Flair at that stage still wrestling. And he started to get hurt. Flair was always a guy that had the reputation of very rarely getting hurt. You never heard of him having any major, major, major injuries. Hogan, even sadder, watching him at that age, you know, climbing the ring. And even after he left WWE the second time, and he and Flair had that match in Australia. They did a whole tour, you know, built around those guys. That was the last tour Umaga did, I think, before he passed away. And just the pictures of them, like, bleeding all over each other, and Flair with the hair looking like Uncle Creepy over there. I mean, it was sad. And those two guys are, or should have been, and Flair, I think, to a large degree still is, looked at as wrestling royalty, right? I don't know too many people that look at those guys now, especially Hogan, as wrestling royalty. Look at all the shit that Hogan's been through. You know, even outside of wrestling, from the reality show to the divorce to the sex tape to the N-word. I mean, everything that's happened to this guy. The money problems both of them have had, especially Flair from all the divorces. Almost like he has to keep working because he has to make money to pay all these women. It's just, I don't know, it's this fall from grace, particularly with Hogan, it's this fall from grace that's just sad, because these were the biggest names in wrestling, and they were so revered by so many people, and all these years later, you look at where they are now, and you just shake your head, like, how did it come to this? This is Ric Flair, this is Hulk Hogan, you know, these guys should be way up here, on a pedestal, and they're not. But I make the comparison with Flair, to go back to your original question, I think it's a similar deal, where Flair had stepped away and not had the run in WWF even. If he had just been an NWA guy and never even went to WWF the first time and won the Rumble and headlined Mania against Savage and then went back to WCW and was part of the Monday Night Wars and then came back to WWE. It was this whole other career that this guy had. If you take all of that away and Flair stepped away in 93, 92, 93, even 91, when he had the fallout with Jim Herd and he quit, or got fired, depending on whoever you believe, Flair would still absolutely be regarded as one of the greatest of all time. And his matches and everything now would live on the network, and he can be an ambassador. You know, he'd still be involved. Same thing with Hogan. Hogan was, you know, he cemented himself that first run in the mid-80s. Forget even the late 80s. He cemented himself then and there as one of the all-time top draws and one of the all-time biggest stars. And everything that came after that was just gravy. And then there was more stuff that came after that that actually hurt him and hurt his, his standing, I guess, more than anything. It's not as though he needed the WCW run to validate his legendary status. He was already a legend, just like Flair was already a legend. But their careers went on and on and on, and they had some good moments, and unfortunately, they had some not-so-good moments. It's just how it goes. KJ has a buy or sell. Ultimate Warrior in 1990, or Bill Goldberg in 1998? That's a good one. That is a good one. You know, there's actually a lot of comparisons between the two of them. They were both, these big, big jacked up dudes. Obviously, Warrior more jacked up than Goldberg, but these big, strong guys that had limited ability in the ring, right? Nobody will look at Goldberg or Warrior as being a great mat technician, but they didn't have to be, right? That wasn't their role. They were the big, scary-looking guys that went in there and beat the hell out of you. So nobody will mistake them for, a Bret Hart or a Shawn Michaels. They appealed to a different crowd. They were these larger-than-life superhero types. Warrior was very colorful with the tassels and the multicolored championship belts. Goldberg was very basic. Goldberg was like Steve Austin on steroids. I don't mean that literally, although he may have been. But, Goldberg was physically bigger than Austin, but he was bald, and he had the black boots and the black trunks, and he had gloves on, but that was it. There was no colorful robe. He didn't cut hardly any promos, and when he talked, it was very brief. It was very much to the point. It wasn't all gibberish like the Warrior. Goldberg would get on the mic, and he would go, "Who's next?" And he would go backstage. Goldberg was the perfect prototype of how to book a guy like that, and I think they could really learn something when it comes to like Roman Reigns and people like that. Goldberg literally walked out. It didn't take longer than a minute or two. He beat the crap out of his opponent. Spear, jackhammer, back to the showers. Rarely spoke, and when he did, it wasn't some meandering 10-15-minute boring scripted promo in the ring. And guess what? It worked. It worked. And I know back then it was a different audience. It was 18 to 34-year-olds, but I think the Goldberg character, if it was booked the same exact way now in WWE, just like Brock Lesnar works, Brock Lesnar, when he comes out, he feels special, he feels different. There's a different vibe in the crowd when he comes out. Goldberg could be just as successful now as a character as he was back then, even with a completely different audience. Even with an audience now of a mixture of kids and 40-year-olds, and maybe they don't have as many 18 and 20-something-year-olds, it would still work because it's such a simple formula. And you don't have to just copy it. You don't have to copy the exact Goldberg formula for everybody, but just, just take bits and pieces from it. Take the basic framework of it, and you want to get somebody like a Roman Reigns over. You don't have to overthink these things. It's very simple. This guy should be a silent ass kicker. I said earlier, after that promo last Monday, holy shit. This guy should not speak. He should not say a word for the next 6 months. He should just go dead silent. And it would be a hell of a lot better than what they have him doing now. It would be a hell of a lot more effective. Because Roman Reigns does not have to be out there doing story time. It doesn't have to be story time with Roman every single week. Now I'm getting off topic again, but that's what made Goldberg such a draw. Now, if you compare their careers, okay, so Warrior's big moment, his big claim to fame, what was it, right? It was the win over Hogan in 1990, right? He beat him in the main event of WrestleMania, he won the championship, and that was it. After that, it was pretty much downhill for the guy. He never had as big of a moment. That was really the pinnacle of his career. For Goldberg, it was very similar. It was a match with Hogan. It was a win over Hogan. Fast forward 8 years, right? He was on live TV. He beat Hogan in front of a big crowd, 40,000 people in the Georgia Dome, almost as many people as that they had in the Sky Dome. And he beat Hogan for the championship. It was almost the exact same scenario, except Hogan was the heel. And this was on TV and not on pay-per-view. Their careers, they really, when you think about it, they really mirror each other in a lot of ways, right? Limited ability, but they took what they had and they made it work. Larger-than-life superhero types. Now, Warrior was, I guess, in a lot of ways, you could say he was kind of a flop as the champion. He didn't light the world on fire. They kept the belt on him for almost a year, but they took it off him because it just wasn't working. They went right back to what they had before. That was never the plan. The plan when they took the title of Hogan in 90 was not to just get it back on Hogan a year later. They wanted to make a new star. They wanted to transition Hogan out of that role, make him an attraction who didn't necessarily need the belt, and it just didn't work out. So they went back to their tried and true, right? We see them now with John Cena. When they try something new and it doesn't work, what do? They get scared and they go back to their tried and true. Let's go back to John Cena. They were doing the same thing back in 1990 as they do today. With Goldberg, it was still working, but look what they did with Goldberg. 6 days after Goldberg won the championship, they had a pay-per-view. Who was in the main event of that pay-per-view? Hulk Hogan, right? Dennis Rodman, I think. Goldberg was defending the championship, their world title, underneath in a match against Kurt Hennig. And God bless Kurt Hennig, Mr. Perfect, I love him to death. But that's Goldberg's big first championship defense after this huge win over Hogan. He's not even in the main event of the pay-per-view, and he's defending against Kurt Hennig. So Goldberg's rise and then the big win over Hogan was the pinnacle of his career. He never reached that height again. And when they broke the streak, the undefeated streak, and they had Nash beat him at the end of the year, that was it. I mean, I can't even say that was the beginning of the end. I think in a lot of ways, the beginning of the end was the moment he won that world title. That was the beginning of the descent. But you had the streak ending and the finger poke of doom. And I mean, we've all told the tale of WCW a million times before. He came to WWE. They tried to recapture some of that magic. It was never the same. And I can't say some of the booking there helped him out either. But their careers in a lot of ways mirror each other. As far as who I buy and who I sell, I got to buy on Goldberg and sell on Warrior, because I think Goldberg, I think Goldberg maybe over a shorter period of time, I look at Goldberg as a bigger draw than the Warrior. I think Goldberg was at his peak. I'm going to say Goldberg at his peak was actually a much, maybe not much, but a bigger star. Like a bigger deal than the Ultimate Warrior was. He was a hotter act. Did he make more money? I don't know. Again, Warrior was in WWF for a number of years. He was on top as champion for 10 months or whatever it was. And that was 1990. This was the Monday Night Wars. It was a different time period. I can't tell you if Warrior sold more t-shirts than Goldberg. He probably did, because WCW, as far as merchandising, they were not very good at that kind of thing. They didn't have the same merchandising machine that WWF had at the time. And you know, there have even been stories of some of the undercard guys in WCW when they would release merchandise, like t-shirts for them. It could be a guy like a Jericho. I think Jericho might have even told the story in his book. Their stuff would sell, but then it would register for Hogan. Like, some of the shit that was going on back then was so unbelievable. I mean, it pisses me off just, like, reading about that. That there were guys who were actually getting hot and were selling t-shirts, but it would register as an item for Hulk Hogan, so he would get the residuals for it. I mean, the fix was in WCW as far as who they wanted over and who they didn't. But I just think Goldberg, when I think of him at his peak, as popular as he was and the ratings he was pulling and wrestling was hot. Wrestling was a lot hotter then than it was in 1990. I think I would buy on Goldberg if you told me at their peak, you're going to build a promotion around one guy, you can only pick one, who would it be? You know, Warrior may have had the more colorful personality, but I'm taking Goldberg. I just think the guy was more explosive, he had more appeal, and if I was building a show around this guy with the right opponent, I think I can make a hell of a lot more money off Bill Goldberg, undefeated Bill Goldberg, against somebody than I could the Ultimate Warrior. So I'm buying Goldberg and I'm selling Warrior. Jean from Brooklyn, based on all the angles and promos that she's done between these two periods, buy or sell Stephanie McMahon as the GM of SmackDown from 2002 to 2003, or Stephanie McMahon is part of the Authority from 2013 to the present? Well, the Authority, I am so far done with the Authority. This is a bad time to ask me this question. As bad as Raw is, everything is based around this fucking Authority angle. And let me just say this. Stephanie McMahon is one of the best performers in all of WWE right now. You don't have to like the Authority angle. You don't even have to like what's going on Raw. I sure don't. Okay, and I'm sick and tired of all this bullshit. But as a performer, when she's out there cutting a promo, or if somebody gets one up on her, which doesn't happen very often, and she's throwing a fit, I mean, she has had some of her best performances in the last couple of years. You know, one of the best I've ever seen from her was at the end of Survivor Series last year when Sting came out. Remember, the Authority lost? What a great storyline that was. Dolph Ziggler got the pin. And boy, did they do a lot with Dolph Ziggler. That's number one. Number two, the whole premise was that the Authority lost, and so therefore they had to disband. The Authority was no more. And here we are, almost a year later, and we're still dealing with the Authority. And they wonder why people don't give a shit. But that's neither here nor there. My point in bringing that up is, at the end of that show, Triple H and Stephanie were in shock. They couldn't believe that they lost. Triple H had this look, he just had this lost, spaced out look on his face, and Stephanie had the mother of all meltdowns. She was angry, she was screaming at the fans, Triple H was trying to hold her back, she started flopping around on the floor, and then from the anger and psychosis, she, and I don't mean the wrestler, she went to crying, and she started like just bawling her eyes out and sobbing. Every possible emotion except happiness that you can think of, this woman managed to cover. It was actually quite the spectacle. So I love Stephanie as a performer. I just think this having her come out there and constantly castrate all of the baby faces, not even the heels. It's one thing to do that to the heels because they're heels. But to do that to your baby faces who can't react, they can't respond, they can't hit a woman. And they don't even have to hit a woman. They don't even have the opportunity to really talk back to her. How often do people talk back to Stephanie? And when they do, more often than not, she'll then react back to them. It's like they're going tit for tat here. It's like, who are they trying to get over here? Are they trying to get Stephanie over, or are they trying to get the other person over? And nobody is safe, even John Cena. Nobody is safe from this. That's what I dislike about the Stephanie McMahon character on TV right now. But if you're asking me who do I buy or sell just based overall on the character and their performances and the angles and everything else, I was a big fan of Stephanie when she was the SmackDown GM. I'm buying on the SmackDown GM version of Stephanie McMahon, and I'm selling on the Authority. Yeah, I thought Stephanie was actually quite good as the GM of SmackDown, and you didn't have this nonsense where she was just getting herself over at the expense of other people. I mean, she was this strong female authority figure, but that's the key. Not at the expense of the baby faces. Her real feud was with Eric Bischoff, who was the Raw GM. So they had a little feud going on. And, you know, first of all, I think Stephanie is a very attractive woman, even now. I think she's beautiful. But SmackDown during that period of 2002 to 2003, I thought Stephanie was just smoking hot, personally. I thought she was on fire. The other thing from that period also is one of my all-time favorite SmackDown angles took place on her watch during that period. And she was actually directly involved with the segment as she took a bump. And that was the Billy and Chuck wedding angle, which I thought was great. I thought that whole segment, as far as weddings and all this corny nonsense that they do, this was very well done. This was early on in the brand split. So when Bischoff revealed himself to be the wedding officiator, and then out comes 3-Minute Warning, who are Raw guys, and they're wondering, what are they doing here? They're on Raw, and they beat up Stephanie McMahon and the whole SmackDown roster, John Cena, Eddie Guerrero, Kurt Angle, Rey Mysterio. They all come running out, and the Raw guys, you know, hightail it through the crowd. It was a great angle, right? It was exciting. It actually felt like a little mini invasion. That was the early part of the brand split when they actually had a clue. Somewhere along the way, they forgot how to do the brand split, which is why I have no interest in seeing them do it again now. Because that, I see that question's been asked a lot lately. Oh, would you want to see the brand split? The answer is no. The answer is no. Even if I thought it would work and it might make things a little more exciting, I don't want to see it because they will fuck it up. They do not know how to do a proper brand split. So I don't want to see it. But back then, I mean, SmackDown 0203, that was the A show. SmackDown was the A show over Raw, in my opinion, during that period. And Stephanie was directly involved in that wedding angle. So I'm buying on Stephanie as the GM, and I'm selling on this Authority horseshit. One more buy or sell. It's not wrestling related, but I wanted to stick it in here. This comes from David from Coopersburg, Pennsylvania. Buy or sell. The 2006 New York Mets or the 2015 New York Mets? Both teams won their division and advanced to the NLCS. However, both teams are different. The 2006 Mets had a core of veterans like Pedro Martinez and Tom Glavine. Oh, don't remind me of Tom Glavine. Carlos Delgado and Billy Wagner, supported by youngsters like David Wright and Jose Reyes. The 2015 Mets core is made up of youngsters like Jacob deGrom, Matt Harvey, Noah Syndergaard, and Michael Conforto, supported by veterans like David Wright and Curtis Granderson. Which team was your favorite and had or has the best chance at winning the World Series? I'm loving this 2015 Mets squad. the whole, especially the second half of the season, once they made certain trades around the trade deadline, brought in some new people, it just feel like the team feels fun. Like there's a chemistry there that wasn't there before. Like you said, it is mostly made up of younger guys. It's not like the old Yankee teams, just, you know, you kind of buy whoever you want to buy, and it's a bunch of old guys. You take this piece from here and this piece from here, and hey, we have a fucking all-star team. This is a team that is largely made up of young arms and young guys that they have grown from within the organization. And yes, they've pulled in some people here and there, but it's to complement all of the young guys that they already had. To me, those are the most fun. Like, those are the teams you want to see do well. You want to see them succeed. You want to see them go all the way. And they just seem to be having fun. Like, everybody seems to, almost like they're best friends. I mean, I'm not saying they are, but they're just a fun team to watch. And the Mets have not always had fun teams to watch. So that's why I'm buying on this year's team and I'm selling the 06 team. As far as who had the best chance to win the World Series, it still haunts me. It still haunts me because, look, you never know, right? If they go to the World Series that year, you never know who wins. I think they win the whole thing. But they should have been at the very least, that World Series. That absolutely should not have happened the way it did. And for it to come down to Game 7 and just watching that pitch from Wainwright sail in and Beltran just stands there looking at it, I can hardly think of a more painful way for that season to end than the way it did. And they should have been in the World Series that year. That team definitely had the talent to go all the way. But I feel this team does too. So it's hard for me to pick one over the other as far as who had the best chance. I think they both had an equally great chance of going to the World Series and winning the whole thing. But in 06, that was their year. And it just didn't happen. But I'm optimistic. As a Mets fan, that's hard. But I'm cautiously optimistic about this season. So far, so good. Yeah, there's going to be a game tonight. Game 1 was last night. They're up 1-0. I'm cautiously optimistic. All right, so it's time to talk about match number 5 in the countdown to 8 of my favorite WWE matches of all time. We've been counting down the last few weeks. We are doing one match a week, no particular order, straight through until the November 8th 8-year anniversary podcast. This is match number 5, and it is a fairly recent match. There have been some matches in this countdown that go back some over 20 years. Although I did do the WrestleMania 25 match, which isn't that old. This is a match from last year. In fact, this is a match from the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view in 2014. And it is one of the greatest WWE matches, certainly in the last decade. It's up there as one of the best, one of the more enjoyable, one of the most fun, and one of the best six-man tag team matches that they've done. And it was the very first battle between The Shield and the Wyatt family. They had been building this. It had been building for a while, really. And the first real tease of it that I can remember, I think, may have been on a taped UK episode of Raw the previous November. I don't remember what the circumstances were, although I know Punk and Bryan were involved. And in any event, there was something that happened, and The Shield and the Wyatt family kind of came to a head between them, but then it never went anywhere. It was almost like an initial tease. Let's see how the people react to it, and then if they react well, we'll come back to it. Well, they did come back to it. And these two teams and the build-up on Raw, you know, the weeks before, they went face-to-face. They did this tease. They wouldn't touch, and then they would, one team would climb up on the apron and the other team would climb up on the apron, and the people were going nuts. They weren't even touching. This is before they even touched, and the people were already chanting, "This is awesome." So it all built to this match at the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view. Roman Reigns was kind of the de facto leader of the Shield. That's how he was positioned, Bray Wyatt being the leader of the Wyatt family. Both teams came out, Shield first. Wyatts were out. I think the Shield came out first. The Wyatts were outside. And before the match even started, they're not even in the ring together. The bell has not sounded. The crowd was chanting, "This is awesome." The people were pumped for this match. When was the last time you can remember a match, in WWE at least, where the match hasn't even started yet, they're just staring at each other, and people are chanting, "This is awesome"? Doesn't happen very often. And look at who was involved here, right? This wasn't Sting or Brock Lesnar or Batista or Triple H or The Rock. It wasn't some star from yesteryear or some 50-year-old dude that they had to bring back just to get a crowd reaction and pop a buyer. No, these were young guys that they had trained that had come out of the developmental system. I mean, they would probably argue that all of these guys came out of NXT, but that's not true because some of them came out of FCW. But still, it was developmental. These were young guys that came out of the developmental system. 3-on-3. No headline main event guys, no old guys being brought back. That's what was so cool about it. They had two fresh, young, original acts. The Shield was an original act. The Wyatt family was an original act. It was not a retread of the NWO or something else that was created elsewhere or that was created 15 years before. And they got over. And the people wanted badly to see these two teams go head-to-head. They fell fucking ass backwards into this thing because I can't believe that, long-term, this had been the plan to put these two teams together. They tried something, it got a reaction, and they reacted, they went with it. They fell into something magical. And this match, when it was over, it lived up to expectations. I don't see how you can watch this first match between these two teams and feel, I feel disappointed. Oh, I feel cheated. Oh, I feel they didn't live up to expectations. They didn't reach their full potential. They knocked it out of the fucking park with this match. And in fact, they had a rematch a few weeks later, maybe about a month later, on Raw. I think it was the Raw in Chicago. And the only reason I remember that is because CM Punk had just left, he had just left the company. And there were still people thinking on that Chicago Raw at the beginning of March that he was going to show up. And in fact, I think the Usos may have beaten the New Age Outlaws on that show for the tag team belts. They were building it up as a big show. And I think on that show is where they had the rematch. And I remember the rematch being also excellent. And the one thing I can say before I talk a little bit about the match itself here, they really, really, really dropped the ball. Because this is something that should have been built. It should have culminated in a match of WrestleMania. Maybe they should have saved it. Maybe they should have saved it as a match of WrestleMania. They could have done some singles matches leading up to it at Mania. This feud deserved to go on for longer than it did. They cut it off way too early. There was so much mileage that was still left in the Shield against the Wyatts. And then, of course, later on, they broke up the Shield, then they broke up the Wyatts. At least with the Shield, I can almost understand it. They had big plans for Seth Rollins. Say what you want to about Seth Rollins now and the way he's been booked or he's boring or whatever. He's the World Heavyweight Champion, right? He's one of the top guys in the company. So he's sitting on cloud nine. He's exactly where he wants to be. He's probably making good money. He's one of the biggest stars in wrestling. Roman Reigns, they have that plan for him. He's on his way. Dean Ambrose, I hope they have the same for him, but right now he's just kind of there. With the Wyatt family, though, I don't understand what the rationale was for breaking them up. Like I said, the Shield, okay, you made a few stars out of it, but the Wyatt family, they never should have been broken up in the first place. They ended up just putting them back together. They were all weaker for being broken up. Right? Sometimes the sum of all the parts together is a lot stronger and it means a lot more than the parts on their own. And that was the case with the Wyatt family. That was a fuck up from day one. They never should have broken them up. And I talk a lot about Roman Reigns. I know it's like I'm beating a dead horse here because I've talked about Roman a couple of different times now on this podcast. And I'm going to mention it again here. Look at the way that Roman Reigns was positioned in this feud. He was the de facto, he was positioned as the leader of the Shield. You can call Rollins the leader, the architect, whatever the hell it is they call him. It was Bray and it was Roman. And Roman rarely spoke. He showed up. He had a pissed off mean scowl on his face. He stood up to the Wyatt family and he said, bring it on. Let's do this. Let's fight. That's the Roman Reigns that people want to see. That's the Roman Reigns that got over, that people actually cheered for. Each guy represented a different piece of the Shield. And again, kind of like the Wyatts, it worked when you put them all together. But this was Roman Reigns at his best. And the story they told here in this match was very simple. Early on, it was back and forth, back and forth. Eventually they got to the point where Rollins, they were getting the heat on Rollins, they were beating him down and beating him down. Same thing with Ambrose until Roman eventually got the hot tag. The action spilled outside the ring about midway through the match. That was when they put Rollins through the announce table. They had Harper and Rowan standing on the American announce table, the English table, and they lifted him high up into the air, and I don't know if it was a choke slam so much as just pressed him down. He crashed through the Spanish announce table, so now he's wiped out. There was a point in the match where, and it might have actually come before this, where Bray and Dean had battled, they wrestled over the barricade. They came so close to kicking some of the kids at ringside. I mean, they were just beating the hell out of each other. They brawled into the crowd. We never did find out where Dean went, which, you know, the conspiracy theorist in me at first thought, well, maybe there's a reason for this. Maybe this is going to lead to Dean being the one to turn on the Shield, because we never did find out where he disappeared to. He never came back to help his teammates out, right? I always thought it was going to be Dean as the one to sell out and go heel, because I still think Ambrose is a heel and Rollins as the babyface is where the real money is. And maybe at some point we will get to that. But we never did find out what happened to Dean. He and Bray battled into the crowd. Bray came back. He didn't. Now Rollins is wiped out. And this is my favorite part of the match. So Roman Reigns is in the ring. He's just half beaten dead. The Wyatt family is looking at this guy. They're going to pick the bones. They're circling the ring. Roman looks around. He realizes he's all by himself. He's got nobody to turn to here. And like any true good superhero, he's like, fuck it, bring it on. And as Bray, he goes after Bray. Of course, the others attack him from behind. And they're just kicking the crap out of this guy. He's fighting back. He's throwing Superman punches. My favorite part of the match is when Bray had Roman set up for Sister Abigail. And Roman grabs Bray by the arm. You know, he's bent over. He grabs Bray by the arm. And he starts to create some separation. He's breaking out of the hold. And Bray's just looking at him like he can't believe this guy's muscling out of the move. And Roman muscles out of it. They're now standing, you know, basically holding each other face to face. Bray throws a couple of headbutts. Roman shakes it off. Roman looks right in Bray's face and just screams. He just screams, like a primal scream, and then he picks up Bray, gives him a Samoan drop, my favorite part of the whole match. Roman is just a house of fire. He takes out Rowan, he takes out Harper, he takes out Bray, right? He gives Bray, I think he gave Bray a Superman punch. Now he's getting ready, he's getting all pumped, right? He's getting pumped for the spear. He's going to spear him and end the match. Harper comes in, he saves Bray by jumping in harm's way. Bray gives him the spear. Bray comes out of nowhere, I should say Roman gives him the spear. Bray comes from out of nowhere, I mean like a rocket ship out of hell. And I don't even know what you call this move. It's like a body check, but he just wipes out Roman Reigns, gives him, immediately gives him a Sister Abigail and gets the pin. People were giving this thing a standing ovation when it was over. The announcers were exhausted. I was exhausted. The match went, it had to go every bit of 20, 25 minutes, so they gave it plenty of time. They didn't rush it. This was exactly what it needed to be. This felt, you know what this felt like? This felt like a war, which is exactly what this match should have been. This match should have been a fucking war, and that's exactly what it was. It's a rare example of WWE in every single possible way of getting something right. And it just goes to show you that when they get it right, wrestling can be a lot of fun. Okay, their product can be a lot of fun when they pull their head out of their ass and they get it right. Even if they fell into this by accident, I don't care. All I know is this was a special match. It was a special night. The rematch that they had, about a month later, whatever it was equally very good. If I had to rank them, it's been so long since I've seen the rematch, I still think it's hard to top the specialness of the first one. So the first one's probably my favorite. The fact that we never got another match between these two teams after this, to me, is such a waste. Look what happened to WrestleMania. Look at how the WrestleMania card shaped out that year. It was John Cena against Bray Wyatt, and it was the Shield in a throwaway match, a throwaway six-man tag that went all of 2 minutes against Kane and the New Age Outlaws. If you blinked, you would have missed their match. And the Shield was better than that. They deserved more than just a two-minute squash at WrestleMania. Hindsight being what it is, we look back on it now, I look back on it now, and I say to myself, there is absolutely no reason you couldn't have had a third and decisive match, even if you wanted to cut the feud off at that point, because you knew in a couple of months you were going to break up the Shield, so we got to blow this thing off. This feud, if they were going to blow it off, this feud deserved a blow off at WrestleMania, because when I look back on that show, there was absolutely nothing they did on that WrestleMania show with these guys that was better than what they could have done by just matching them up one more time. They could have had the third match. I don't know. I don't even know if you can give it a stipulation. You could have put it inside Hell in a Cell. I don't know if that would have limited what they were able to do, if it would have made the match worse, if it would have made the match better. It would have been weird having a war with these guys inside the cage and not having blood, but maybe that would have been the way to go. Or have some, whatever gimmick. You don't even need a gimmick. You could have just put them in the ring and said, this is the final time. This is going to be the war to end all wars. That would have been much better than what they did, looking back on it. Instead, you had John Cena pin Bray Wyatt. Stupid. There was no reason to have John Cena pin Bray Wyatt. I don't even know that Bray Wyatt had been pinned, at least not cleanly. That might have been his first clean pinfall loss. Now, I could be wrong about that, but you know, that's the one that stands out to me. Now, I guess the idea was, well, they're going to have a series of matches, and Bray will win the second one, and then John Cena will win the third one. First of all, I don't see what good that does Bray Wyatt. And there are still people that will debate me on this. You will never convince me that this feud from last year between John Cena and Bray Wyatt was to benefit Bray Wyatt. It benefited him because he could hang with John Cena. Take that nonsense and stick it up your ass, okay? Because I don't want to hear it. That feud did more harm than good to that guy. And there was no reason for him to lose at WrestleMania. Look at the one win that he had, too. Remember how he won? Oh, what a decisive win that was. A fucking little kid that we never saw again scared John Cena. Well, which kind of makes sense, I guess, because we all know what John Cena thinks about kids. So it kind of makes sense that he would see one, maybe thought it was his, and he was spooked. But the kid beat John Cena. Bray Wyatt can't beat John Cena, but a little kid can. So that whole thing was just a freaking abortion. It never should have happened in the first place. And it absolutely would have made sense to just blow this thing off at WrestleMania. It's not like these guys were doing anything any better, right? Hindsight being what it was. I mean, people may have thought at the time, hey, it's John Cena. It can't get any bigger than that. You know, what a mistake that turned out to be. And that's the one gripe I have. This feud was clicking. It was firing on all cylinders. It was so great. It was the best thing going at the time in WWE, and if anything, it would have been still sad to see it end, but it deserved a proper blow-off at WrestleMania, not on a random episode of Monday Night Raw. So if you've never seen this match before, most of you, I would imagine, have seen it, but if you haven't, then you got to get on that. And if it's been a while, I went back and I watched it, and I would suggest that you do the same, because it's every bit as fun to go back and watch it now as it was last year. It's up on the network right now, Elimination Chamber 2014, check it out. And next week, we'll have match number 6 on the countdown. We got 3 more to go through here. And hopefully you guys are enjoying this as much as I am. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can keep emailing them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @solomonster is my handle. Lots of different ways to support the podcast. If you like what you hear, if you like all the work I put into this show for you guys every single week, you can make a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com. Use our Audible link. I appreciate the hell out of you guys that are taking advantage of that. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Sign up, cash in, get your free book. The Daniel Bryan book is still up there, and it's narrated by him. And you can also buy a shirt in our store, prowrestlingtees.com/Solomonster. Over 20 shirts to choose from. They ship all over the world. In your size, however big or small you may be, I assure you, your size is up there. And don't forget, this Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, I will be on Under the Mat Radio, blogtalkradio.com/Under the Mat Radio. It'll be archived there after the fact if you can't listen live. So tune in for that. Next weekend is it's Hell in a Cell next weekend, isn't it? I actually don't even know if I'm going to be watching Hell in a Cell live. It depends if there's a baseball game that night. I guess we'll see. But we will do Hell in a Cell predictions on the podcast, episode 406, next weekend. So until then, be well, stay safe. Enjoy the Stone Cold podcast with Brock Lesnar this Monday night. And we'll see you right back here again for more of the Sound Off next weekend. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Watch these promos on NXT. Watch Raw. Watch a Randy Orton promo or a Sheamus promo. They never, ever look at the camera. It's because that's what they teach them now. You are not allowed to look into the camera. I think it's just completely idiotic. Why are their eyes not on me? That's how interviews always were. They're talking to me. They're speaking to us. They're supposed to be speaking to the fans. Maybe that's part of the reason why these people can't make a connection with the audience. Because they don't fucking look at us.
The Solomonster Sounds Off. since 2007.
The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monsters Sound Off.